Some characteristics of philosophic understanding. My general argument is that a proper education today requires that individuals accumulate and recapitulate the intellectual capacities represented by each of these kinds of understanding and deploy them together in some manner yet to be made clear. Philosophic and romantic understanding, and no doubt the mythic kind too, trumpeted their historical development by setting themselves up in opposition to their predecessor. Or, at least, that is how some of their more polemical proponents represented them. I used Hecatius's dismissal of the stories of his ancestors as emblematic of the early rational contempt for mythic thinking, and Thucydides' The Hippocratics, Aristotle, Bacon, Descartes, and so on, as decriers of earlier and contemporary romantic inquiries. This common feature of Western cultural history is unfortunate for many reasons, not least because it seems to take most people a long time to recognize that the preceding kind of understanding is not simply the pit of villainous confusion represented by its successors, but in fact forms a foundation to their own preferred kind. In cases where people have deliberately struggled to extirpate all vestiges of prior kinds of understanding, the result seems to be sterility, desiccation, and a danger of inhumanity in the development of the new kind. It seems fair to describe positivism and behaviorism as examples of this. As Charles Taylor puts it, quote, "Once one is broken out from the worldview of a very narrow form of naturalism, it seems almost unbelievable that anyone could ever have taken a theory like behaviorism seriously. It takes a very powerful metaphysical set of preconceptions for one to ignore or override so much that is so intuitively obvious about human life, for no valid scientific or explanatory reason." End quote. The polemical accompaniment to the development of philosophic understanding represents the new form as sweeping away the insubstantial folk knowledge, the emotionalism, the metaphor-induced confusion, the glittering superficiality of its predecessors, and replacing these with cold, hard factuality and sharp-edged theoretical truth. This is the stance of the self-consciously tough-minded. But the cultural development has come, in Ong's phrase, quote, "not in the hollow of men's minds, but in the density of history," end quote. The gender reference in the quotation is notable in that the communities that have supported philosophic understanding in the density of history were, until the 20th century, almost exclusively male. All the developers of philosophic understanding mentioned in the previous section were men. Does this mean that philosophic understanding, engendered by a gaggle of patriarchs, is a masculine form of thinking? Is my scheme, which will recommend philosophic understanding as a necessary acquisition in the process of becoming educated, simply another of those sexist developmental theories that prescribes male intellectual norms into which women are simply supposed to fit? If a third layer of understanding had been developed in the matrix of women's minds, and the density of a female-dominated history, would we have seen something different from the philosophic kind being characterized here? That is philosophic understanding only contingently gender-biased, or is it necessarily a male-oriented kind of thinking? I doubt that any conclusive answer can yet be given, though I suspect that any gender association of philosophic understanding will prove to be almost entirely contingent, to a point of vanishing significance for educational purposes. Any evident difference in access to and ease in using philosophic thinking between males and females must be largely a product of women's lack of access to the communities that formed and supported such thinking. Their absence from these discussions continues to have profound and pervasive residual effects on the ways they are treated in such communities today, on the expectations held of them by males, and on their own expectations of themselves. That the slant and tone of, and styles of initiation into, the most prominent traditions of philosophic thinking give evidence of male bias, particularly in the sciences and mathematics, seems to me a product of the polemics that have accompanied their development in male-dominated communities, not something essential to philosophic thinking itself. A feature of these polemics, as I suggested above, is that they depreciate kinds of understanding that are properly foundational to the philosophic. My argument is that adequate philosophic understanding must incorporate the capacities acquired while developing mythic and romantic understanding. When we see philosophic understanding enriched by imagination, metaphoric thinking, romantic associations, and so on, it will, I trust, be less vulnerable to claims of gender bias. Philosophic understanding begins to become prominent today at roughly age 15. Why this should be the case, I will address below, but I want to emphasize that this is not something that happens routinely as a result of maturation. Systematic development of philosophic understanding seems at present normal for only a smallish proportion of the population. Those who enter and interact with communities that support this kind of thinking, such as some academic streams in senior high schools and in colleges and universities, and who also have adequately accumulated mythic and romantic capacities. The craving for generality. Earlier, we saw Snell's argument that developments in the Greek language were prerequisite to abstract, theoretic thinking. So, too, in early modern Europe, we find significant shifts in language preceding and accompanying the period when the philosophers and scientists programs were getting underway. Lucien Febvre, 1878 to 1956, co-founder of the French Annals School of Historians, pointed out that the 16th century French language lacked words for absolute, relative, abstract, concrete, intentional, inherent, transcendental, causality, regularity, concept, criterion, analysis, synthesis, deduction, induction, coordination, classification, system, and a range of terms that the philosophic programs of the next century would use prominently. According to the databanks of the American Research on the Treasury of the French Language, the word society was used 620 times in the century before 1700, and 7,168 times in the following two. Latin, of course, was still important for scholarly discourse and was not as impoverished as the vernaculars in this regard. But beginning in the 16th century and becoming a flood in the 17th, words flowed into the vernaculars. In the process, many of them seemed to gain a metaphoric extension from a restricted, relatively concrete meaning in Latin to a more free, flexible, abstracted use in the vernaculars. Take, for example, the word hierarchy. It comes from the Greek hieros, meaning sacred or holy, and arches, meaning ruling. It was used to designate a state ruled by priests. The word later became Latinized and Christianized to refer to the ninefold rank of angels, the hierarchia of cherubs, seraphs, and other sadly neglected creatures. Oh, very well, if you insist. Seraphim, cherubim, thrones, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities, angels, and archangels. It arrived in Middle English as hierarchy, with its Latin meaning. It commonly occurred with more or less its modern spelling and medieval meaning in the 16th century. In the 17th century, the word was extended to apply not only to angels, but to the ranks of the clergy, a somewhat different group. And very soon thereafter, we find its metaphoric extension to mean any graded system, much as we use the term today. Words like evolution, concept, deduction, causality, and many of those listed by Favre follow a roughly similar trail, the Oxford English Dictionary indicating significantly new and more flexible meanings adopted through the 17th century. The result was an enriched conceptual vocabulary for dealing with the enlarging realm of theory. Walter Ong relates this development in modern Europe to an effect of the printing press and the massive accumulation of detailed documented knowledge. The security and accessibility of constantly enlarging bodies of knowledge allowed people to generate what he calls portmanteau concepts like culture, civilization, and evolution. Clearly, the Greeks managed to develop related concepts without the printing press, but perhaps the peculiar modern European shape of philosophic understanding owes much, as Ong and McLuhan suggest, to the constantly replicating thump of the press. The vocabulary of late adolescents engaged in academic work commonly begins to sprout portmanteau concepts, including many of those mentioned above. Ong emphasizes that such terms cannot be generated, however, without a significant accumulation of detailed knowledge. Sometimes we find words students had long known and could have defined, such as society, quite suddenly emerge into their everyday serious discourse with energy and prominence. Clearly the word has taken on a new and more precise meaning. Some referent of the word has come into focus. Society is no longer a vague term used by adults to refer to an amorphous, indistinct concatenation of houses and services and politicians, but becomes the name for the general entity that encompasses all those bits and pieces. It is though an object has been discovered, a very complex one, but one that can be grasped by means of the portmanteau term. We can commonly note words like nature, culture, the environment, system, and process being used to refer to a theoretic world whose abstract inhabitants begin to emerge as clear, definite, real things. Society might be an enormous generalization, but, to the philosophic mind, it refers to something real, not just something made up of the sum of its parts, but something having a reality more intellectually apprehensible than the sum of its parts. Indeed, the parts begin to take on meaning in terms of their place in the greater whole. In the development of the theoretic realm, the new objects that come into focus are significantly different from those illuminated by the perspective of romantic understanding. The slight disjunction of metaphors in the last sentence is deliberate. Bringing into focus, illuminating, and perspective are somewhat at odds with each other, preventing a simple image from developing. The visual metaphors we commonly deploy to discuss ideas can easily displace the slippier realm of concepts with the solid realm of physical objects. The point of this perhaps overly cute observation is that philosophic understanding, particularly when we initially engage it, seems prone to this displacement, taking the very general concepts as though they refer to something tangible, but they will appear so only to those whose thinking is excessively philosophical. As former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher notoriously claimed, quote, there is no such thing as society, end quote. The romantic perspective on history or on the social or natural worlds focused the younger student's mind on the extremes, on the more fascinating facts, on vivid true stories, dramatic events, heroes, and so on. The romantic student recognizes, of course, that all these bright bits and pieces are parts of the one real world, but the connections among them are not particularly interesting. The new theoretic language helps to generate, or is a symptom of, a significantly different perspective in which the bright bits and pieces are seen increasingly as parts of general wholes, systems, and processes. History, for example, is no longer perceived primarily as a set of vivid events, styles of living, and heroic characters, but rather as a single complex process, a continuum of styles, examples of the possible range of human behavior and human nature. The connections among things come increasingly into prominence, and the philosophic student's connection with things comes increasingly from the realization that they themselves are parts of the complex processes and systems that make up the world. This perception gives rise to new questions about the nature of the historical process. Is it an ameliorative one, in which the nasty, brutal, and short life of our savage ancestors gradually became a harmonious, healthy, intellectually enriched experience? Or perhaps it is a tragedy in which things began to fall apart for humans with the invention of agriculture, which led to private property, population explosions, and social disruption, surpluses and hierarchies, as Rousseau and Saint-Simon viewed it. Or perhaps the agricultural utopia was destroyed by the discoveries of metallurgy, which led to hierarchies, hereditary secrets, a primitive bourgeoisie, greed, and war, as V. Gordon Child presents it. Or perhaps the invention of writing was the cause of all our woes. What are the laws that determine the natural world? What is the truth about society? What is natural human behavior? What, the unsophisticated philosophic mind accepts as a meaningful question, is the meaning of life? The philosophic mind focuses on the connections among things, constructing theories, laws, ideologies, and metaphysical schemes to tie together the facts available to the student. The student then begins to acquire the knowledge necessary for rounding out the scheme. Take, for example, a discussion stimulated by local political candidates' lawn and window signs during a current election campaign. The romantic child asks whose side we are on, why the different parties use the colors they do, and so on. The philosophic 15-year-old wants to know details of the process that accounts for the electioneering sign's presence on lawns or in windows. Do the parties or candidates pay to rent space on the lawns, like advertising, or do people pay the party to get the signs? Do they have to pay more for a big one than for a small one? How many people are swayed by such signs? What kinds of people? Wouldn't the money be better spent on TV ads? Bit by bit, the 15-year-old composes the information required to flesh out an understanding of the election process. What I have described here is a development that many people, some of whom I quote below, have observed and referred to. It is a development based on empirical observations of students in contact with philosophic communities around this age, and on a study of the reading, films, TV shows, writing, games, and stories that such students identify as most interesting and important to them. But I will not be citing supporting empirical research, for two related reasons. First, I am not aware of any. Current research methods in psychology and education would have difficulty grasping, for example, changes in vocabularies and changes in the use and meanings of terms over a period of many months to a few years. Second, we have not hitherto had a sufficiently clear theory of this development to guide researchers to devise empirical tests. The one theory that makes some overlapping observations is Piaget's. His notion of formal operations, while problematic and the subject of much controversy, does reflect a common recognition of the construction of a theoretic realm in academic students in later adolescence. Piaget focused on a set of internal, spontaneously developing logico-mathematical structures that are paradigmatic philosophic entities, immensely abstract, largely inaccessible, and containing the truth about the process of development. What I describe in general terms as a characteristic of philosophic understanding, that students increasingly identify the truth as belonging in this theoretic realm, Inhelder and Piaget described as follows. Quote, in formal thought, there is a reversal in the direction of thinking between reality and possibility in the subject's method of approach. Possibility no longer appears merely as an extension of an empirical situation or of actions actually performed. Instead, it is reality that is now secondary to possibility. The most distinctive property of formal thought is this reversal of direction between reality and possibility. Instead of deriving a rudimentary theory from the empirical data as is done in concrete inferences, formal thought begins with a theoretical synthesis, implying that certain relations are necessary and thus proceeds in the opposite direction. End quote. This openness to possibility, which is one feature of what I call general schemes, can leave students vulnerable. It has long been evident to those attempting to attract adolescents to some ideological position that intense commitment can be generated by convincing them of the truth of the view of the world it represents. Consider the way typical nation-states enlist the commitment of the young by the presentation of their national story. In liberal and pluralist states, the result is typically a commitment to liberal pluralism. In more determinedly indoctrinating states, such as Nazi Germany, the result can be a passionate dedication, evident in the fervor of young eyes and behavior. A few decades ago, it was not uncommon in Western universities for bright students' minds to be captured by Marxism. Capturing the mind is perhaps a slightly dramatic metaphor, but Marxism's appeal lay in its enormous generality and its promise to tell the general truth about all the facts, events, institutions, emotions, consciousness, past, present, and future, in the interplay of three ideas: the Hegelian thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, each of which takes on different forms in different times and circumstances, but rolls inexorably on. All the disorganized information learned earlier about medieval villages, knights and their ladies, monasteries, and wool production slide neatly into their true places as part of the overarching process of conflict between feudalism and a rising bourgeoisie, which would spawn its own antithetical proletariat, and so on, to the ideal classless society. Such a general scheme has the added virtues of informing the student of his or her own place in the overall process, thereby defining a social role and re-establishing a secure identity. Some general schemes act like a powerful magnet, organizing virtually everything in the student's minds. Others are weaker, bringing about a more diffuse order. Some are very simple, dividing the world for the student into two, good and bad, black and white, right and wrong. Others may be much more sophisticated, generating complex and subtle patterns. Once they emerge in the clutter of the romantic mind, such schemes seem to reach definition quite quickly and to assert their magnetic influence over the clutter. Quote, "When we begin to believe anything, what we believe is not a single proposition. It is a whole system of propositions." End quote. Initial symptoms of philosophic understanding begin to emerge in romantic thinking. Mary Warnock notes how, quote, "imagination can stretch out towards what imagination cannot comprehend." End quote. One of the things it stretches out towards is what used to be called, during the Romantic period, the sublime. The mind was filled with somewhat inchoate but enticing images of infinite space, endless numbers, and eternal duration. As Kant argues, this use of imagination leads us beyond what is accessible to the senses, but also toward the realization that there is something signified by these concepts that we can express, but somehow cannot grasp, though we can grasp toward them. Romantic sublime ideas are not so far removed from the, quote, "Enlightenment's tendency to produce vast schema for society on a universal and historical scale," end quote. The student today who becomes engaged by the Gaia hypothesis, or who sees history in Marxist terms, is recapitulating an intellectual process we can chart in our cultural history. The move from romantic to philosophic understanding follows the stretch of the imagination and the subsequent construction of the linguistic and conceptual tools required to secure the mind's hold on what the imagination grasped toward. Recall my earlier representation of the romantic exploration of a hill town as in the fashion of a tourist, first seeking out the main square, the walls, and the most dramatic features. The philosophic exploration might be represented as that of a mapmaker, for whom all the features are significant in the creation of an accurate representation of the whole town. From transcendent players to social agents. One constant of cultural history is the changing sense of self. The major theoretical advancements of the modern world, from Copernicus's new model of our place in the universe to Darwin's new model of our place in the natural world, had major impacts on people's sense of their selves. Aristotle's observations that humans are social animals achieved a new gloss in the growing cities of the 16th and 17th centuries. No one is an island. Our sociability and interdependence were increasingly recognized as due not simply to our all being related as children of God, but to something in our animal nature. During this period, people become increasingly historical animals. We may have a nature, but it is an historical one, cultural nature. The general cosmological and evolutionary schemes, the latter had been broached long before Darwin came up with a mechanism that would explain the sequence of changes in the fossil records, provided new and not always welcome ways of determining one's sense of self. As modern students recapitulate such schemes, their sense of self changes as well. The romantic self, sustained by associations with chosen embodiments of transcendent human qualities, the pop singer, sports player, social activist, self-sacrificing helper, begins to fade into the background. Students begin to see that they are connected to the world, not via transcendent associations, but by complex causal chains and networks. They come to realize that they are born with a past, and that the past not only constitutes the present self, but begins to shape the future. On the one hand, this may seem a terrible loss of freedom, a later departure from another Eden. But on the other hand, it yields a more adequate grasp on what is real and true about the world. Students begin to grasp that what we are does not result from romantic choices and associations, but from laws of nature, human psychology, social interactions, history, and so on, which apply to ourselves as to everyone else. The fading of the importance of romantic associations, then, can appear more a matter of putting aside childish things. Having seen us through a glass darkly, students can attain a fuller, theoretic consciousness of their place in the world. The sense of enlarging consciousness comes to many students as liberating and energizing. In his autobiography, W.H. Hudson describes such a change at age 15 in these terms. Quote, "It was as though I had only just become conscious. I doubt that I had ever been fully conscious before." End quote. This is something that nearly all educated people I have surveyed recognize, though some recall it as having more dramatic impact than others. We do not commonly fall off a horse with the impact of the flash of an idea capturing our minds, but it is common for people to use a visual metaphor to characterize what I am calling the relatively sudden access to philosophic understanding. If students perceive themselves to be parts of natural, social, historical, and other processes, their understanding of themselves and their roles in the world depends on their knowledge of how these processes work. During the years from about 15 to the early 20s, then, students will characteristically search for or attempt to sustain a conception of the truth about human psychology, the laws of historical development, and the truth of how societies function. Let us return to Marxism as an example. Here, the student is directed to search out knowledge and perform actions that will point to the contradictions of capitalism, hinder the aims of reactionary bourgeois ideas and activities, and further the cause of the proletariat. How old-fashioned this language has rapidly become. The general scheme, that is, points the mind precisely toward particular knowledge that can support or challenge it, toward behavior that brings it more evidently into reality. Establishing the truth about history, society, and the cosmos is serious business. When philosophic understanding dominates the mind, it can work with powerful intensity. The seriousness of philosophic concerns, and the focus on knowledge that supports or challenges any one general scheme, tends to reduce interest in the extremes and in the dramatic. Romantic knowledge thus is often dismissed as irrelevant, pointless, a trivial pursuit. Romantic hobbies and collections lose their interest. The comic collection is sold, given to the Salvation Army, or stored in the attic to demolish the mortgage some decades on. The doll collection gathers dust for a while before diving into the plastic bag and heading off to the attic or to the infant niece who cannot believe her luck. A note of earnestness common in modern philosophic students echoes Victorian high seriousness. Both are engaged in a serious enterprise, after all, and surrounded by so many people unable to see the truth of the general scheme. The Victorians had missionaries, legislation, and the Gatling gun to carry their truth to the world. Today's philosophic students have social and political action groups, computer modems, and the internet. That the Expanding Horizons general scheme has had so much influence on teaching and the curriculum, especially in North America and Australia, implies that in the last year of high school, the student is able to deal with content distant from the self, knowledge of the self being the educational starting point of that scheme. Note the peculiarity of this expectation about education for students whose private lives in late high school years are haunted by self-consciousness. But there is a sense in which philosophic understanding represents a new and closer apprehension of the self. Educational development, I am suggesting, is a process whose focus of interest and intellectual engagement begins with a myth-like construction of the world, then romantically establishes the boundaries and extent of reality, and then philosophically maps the major features of the world in organizing grids. In this philosophic activity, students recognize themselves as parts of complex processes. They set about establishing the truth concerning them with some psychological urgency, because in doing so, they will discover the truth about themselves. This form of intellectual activity can easily slip into narcissism. Students' interest in the world is not so much for its own sake as for what the discoveries will reveal about themselves. Students become attracted to academic subjects, such as anthropology, psychology, and sociology, that seem to promise direct knowledge about themselves. To the despair of anthropology teachers, many students' interest in other cultures seems directed largely by their desire to know what about themselves is determined by culture and what is their basic human genetic endowment, rather than a desire to study the uniqueness of the people being discussed. The general scheme, the nature of human nature, is what they attend to. Particular information is of interest only to the degree that it enlightens the scheme. If the teaching of these subjects, and of history too, treats the search for general laws and huge explanatory schemes as misguided, philosophic students tend to become disenchanted and switch off, turning perhaps to such magazines as Psychology Today, which deal with the subject in a largely romantic and occasionally philosophic manner. Quote, "The story of my life is always embedded in the story of those communities from which I derive my identity," end quote. To the degree that this is so, education seems largely a matter of, quote, "having an adequate sense of the traditions to which one belongs or which confront one," end quote, and having, quote, An adequate sense of tradition manifests itself in a grasp of those future possibilities which the past has made available to the present. End quote. This need for an adequate sense forms one plank of a platform to be built in this book about the educational necessity of simply knowing a lot. General schemes, to be at all adequate, need to construct their patterns from a wide array of particular knowledge. The more diverse and intricate the factual base for a scheme, the more likely it is to reflect the world reliably. Building reliable general schemes is necessary for the individual student to become a realistic and sensible agent in the world. The lure of certainty. We have inherited, from the classical period and from the Enlightenment, the belief that truth, some ultimate, fundamental truth about the world and our place and purpose in it, is attainable. This belief has mythic and religious roots. The truths that had earlier been accepted as coming appropriately from divine revelation were increasingly accepted as coming from disciplined inquiry. We can see how, during the 17th century, early scientists like the incomparable Mr. Newton saw no sharp division between divine revelation and disciplined inquiry. God has made truth accessible to the person who studied the divine word of the Bible, or the divine work of the physical world. These scientists seemed to believe that God had made the world, and sprinkled it with puzzles, so that solving the puzzles brought greater understanding of God. To the artist and scholar of the humanities, the capacities earlier associated with the soul were increasingly associated with the more secular imagination. A common feature of philosophic understanding is the tendency to assume that the patterns, theories, and general schemes used to order the world are true to the extent that, and in the way that, the particulars from which they are composed are true. That is, it is assumed that the truth of a general scheme is a function of the truth of the facts and events themselves, and that the selection and organization of facts and events can be neutral or objective if appropriate care is taken. Failure to recognize that a general scheme involves reducing the diversity of the world can lead to a common overestimation of the security of one's general scheme and the nature of the truth that such schemes can claim. This tendency to overconfidence in one's own theories has long been noted. The air of authority cultivated by Edinburgh reviewers, for example, readily escalated into arrogance. Sidney Smith satirized his success, suggesting how the typical reviewer might suggest the achievement of constructing the solar system, quote, bad light, planets too distant, pestered with comets, feeble contrivance, could make a better with great ease, end quote. Mary Shelley warned against overconfidence in improving the feeble contrivance of the human being in Frankenstein. Alfred Weber, Max's younger brother, wrote about the dogmatic progressivism and dangerous sort of optimism arising from the Enlightenment's ideology of science and scholarship and its belief that it could secure certainty about the issues they address. To use Freudian terms, one could say that the assertiveness often shown by proponents of philosophic schemes is due to the suppression of their own hidden doubts. The inappropriate sense of certainty that can come with philosophic understanding in individuals' education is observed with disapproval from the classical period to the present. Plato recognized it as a danger point in his educational program. Quote, you must have seen how youngsters, late teens, when they get their first taste of dialectic and the dianoia curriculum, treat argument as a form of sport solely for purposes of contradiction, delighting like puppies in tugging and teasing anyone who comes near them, end quote. The distress of overconfident youths is loud through the Enlightenment. Quote, it is a frequent and growing folly of our age that pert young disciples soon fancy themselves wiser than those who teach them, end quote. Quote, young people never show their folly and ignorance more conspicuously than by this overconfidence in their own judgment and this haughty disdain of the opinion of those who have known more days, end quote. In a more psychologically alert age, like our own, the observation is put into this form. Quote, the tentativeness implicit in the adolescent condition makes youth vulnerable to ideological certainty, end quote. In part, this excessive certainty arises because students are attracted to the power of theoretic ordering concepts without questioning the security of hold, or lack thereof, theories give over the phenomena to which they are applied. And so the, quote, chief source of human error is to be found in general and abstract ideas, end quote, was Rousseau's related conclusion. Earlier, we looked at hierarchy as an example of a term typical of the set that supported philosophic thinking. If we consider how hierarchicization is put to work early in students' experience with philosophic thinking, we can see how the lure of certainty can draw the student toward inappropriate uses. In their later teens, some students begin to appreciate classical music, for example. Pushed by the philosophic impulse, they will try to impose order. They will often argue about who is the best composer, and who is the second best, and so on. In doing so, they tend to search for the most fundamental criterion that will allow them to organize all composers, or football players, saints, actors, automobiles, writers, beers, whatever, by slotting them into place on some hierarchy. Not uncommonly, this leads them to reduce the complexity by imposing an inappropriate single criterion. Of course, it makes little sense to ask who is the best composer, as composers do different things more or less well. But sorting out what one means by that leads to increasingly sophisticated distinctions, and to the related question, best for whom? The notion of best, in terms of a single criterion hierarchy, becomes meaningless. It does, however, make sense to ask who is one's favorite composer. It is common in the early stages of philosophic understanding to confuse one's hierarchical scheme with an objective criterion of truth. Once one has identified the right criterion for ranking composers, or football players, saints, writers, beers, and once one has found the ideology that shows the truth about the historical process, one can feel confident in dealing with particular composers, beers, writers, historical events, or whatever. Understanding them becomes a task of slotting them into place in the scheme or on the hierarchy. The observation that some students are overconfident follows from their seeming to think that they know the meaning of everything. This is an accurate description of many students moving into philosophic thinking. They think they do know the true meaning of everything, even of things they have not yet learned. That is, with an established general scheme, an ideology, an overarching theory, they think that they understand the general principles from which the meaning of particulars is derived. Since they know the truth in general, they consider further learning and organizing the particulars within it as an essentially trivial task, even an unnecessary waste of time. Why bother with details when one already grasps the general truth? General schemes and anomalies. One reason for bothering with details is that their support of general schemes is not always reliable. If intellectual security and even one's sense of self is tied in with the general schemes one uses to make sense of the world and of experience, then one has a vital stake in ensuring the adequacy, validity, and truth of one's schemes. The problem is that, however sophisticated one's general scheme, there always seem to be facts around that do not fit it well at best, and at worst, challenge it. Leopold von Ranke composed a general scheme about the development of modern European history, as did Thucydides about Greek history, and, by implication, all history. Each considered the truth of his general schemes to be established by his meticulous accumulation of reliable details, organized and expressed sine ira studio, without anger or partiality, as Tacitus admonished. The truth of their general schemes emerged from the details, as might a mosaic from the precise placement of its component pieces. That the overall picture looks nothing like the individual pieces that make it up is simply a feature of how mosaics are composed. That the kind of knowledge claimed by a general scheme is not like that claimed by an exhaustively researched historical fact is, to the philosophic inquirer, just an uncontentious feature of how knowledge is built. As I will explore in Chapter 5, a more ironic view tends toward suspicion about patterns emerging from accumulated facts. The ironic eye tends to look for what Cornford called, quote, some scheme of unsuspected presuppositions that determines the selection of facts to compose a particular image. What happens, though, when one turns up facts that do not fit the general scheme, or when supporters of some competing general scheme thrust out such facts? How does a Marxist scheme accommodate the collapse of Eastern European and Russian economic and political systems, and their adoption of capitalist and Western democratic practices? After all, it was the capitalist states that were supposed to collapse. Admittedly, this is an extreme case of facts and events that are anomalous to a general scheme, but the daily life of the philosophic mind is made up of the constant calibration of general schemes to facts. The movement of scientific research seems to follow a formally similar process, as theories evolve and are reconstructed in the face of further facts. Again, the use of somewhat discordant metaphors, calibration, evolution, construction, is intentional, suggesting that the workings of the mind have no precise analogs in the world outside them. The constant interaction between general schemes and particular knowledge fuels students' development through philosophic understanding. The general scheme constantly requires further knowledge to support it. The further knowledge will commonly be somewhat anomalous and require refinements or revisions of the general scheme, which in turn will require further knowledge more adequately to support the newly refined or revised scheme. In the inescapable and irresolvable difference between reality and our ideas about it lies the fuel of philosophic inquiry. A mass of diverse knowledge is necessary to drive the dialectical process between general scheme and particular knowledge, and a good deal more knowledge is required to keep it going. When students accumulate only a relatively small amount of knowledge, or too specialized in knowledge, by the time they enter communities that stimulate and support philosophic thinking, they are able to generate only rather crude and simple general schemes. The problem is not that a crude, simple scheme does not organize enough knowledge, but that it can comfortably organize anything. Simple forms of fundamentalist religious beliefs are a common example. If it is crude enough, everything becomes evidence to support it, and nothing challenges it. Contact with other cultures, on the other hand, tends to compel adjustment of general schemes, or, as Peter Winch observed, quote, seriously to study another way of life is necessarily to extend our own, end quote. European explorations of discovery during the Renaissance generated bundles of anomalies from the general scheme of Christian cosmology. Why had the Christian God created those other races who could have no knowledge of him until the missionaries arrived? And what were European Christians to make of the strange gods of the savages? One could, in the circumstances, forgive a sigh of relief in the Vatican when the first Martian landers discovered no clear signs of life on the planet. Flexible minds can adjust general schemes to accommodate such anomalies, and, of course, C.S. Lewis has already had a go at the theological problems presented by intelligent life elsewhere in the galaxy in Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra. What we have here, incidentally, is a further argument for learning a lot. Everyone holds that ignorance is incompatible with education, but conventional traditionalist arguments for mastering certain forms of knowledge have an arbitrary note to them. They have tried to tie the meaning of education to a liberal tradition of learning a basic amount of a range of disciplines. The progressivist position, in contrast, seems hard put to justify any particular curriculum and the learning of any particular knowledge. Erudition has always taken its place behind other more important progressivist objectives for educational institutions. If the scheme I am composing appears to lean more to the traditionalist, academic, content-rich curriculum, I should emphasize that it also implies significant differences from the canonical content of the traditionalist curriculum. To be a teacher of philosophic students requires flexibility, sensitivity, and tolerance in abundance. The teacher needs to support the students developing general schemes, even when those schemes seem simplistic or perhaps offensive. The teacher needs to be sympathetic with students' occasional overconfidence, and must be ready to support them at those moments of fearful insecurity when the inadequacy of a general scheme threatens. The teacher must introduce anomalies and dissonance gradually to encourage greater sophistication in students' general schemes. Of course, one has to wonder what educational institution can afford such a paragon. Anyone who has dealings with intellectually energetic students will readily be able to translate my abstract talk of disturbances to general schemes into the very real emotional crises and difficulties they encounter. Angst, tears, depression, suicide, pills are among the real-world correlates of the process. It is a lucky student who makes this intellectual journey, buoyed constantly by the excitement of discovery and not dragged down by the distresses and emotional turmoil attending the recognition of inadequacy in the schemes used to make sense of the world. The flexibility of theory. The reader might very well conclude that philosophic understanding represents a regression rather than a development. Thucydides' narrowly focused inquiry, driven by his desire to lay a plot on the diversity of historical events, may seem a step backward in some ways from Herodotus' open-minded exploration of difference and diversity. If this is supposed to be an improving process of cultural development, we might choose not to recapitulate it. We might come to agree with Callicles' wary observation that too much philosophy is the ruin of human life. I did promise a conception of education that involved losses as well as gains. The losses may be only too evident so far. We are all familiar with philosophic thinkers enthralled to general schemes, earnest ideologues, for example, who know that history, God, and the environment and its natural processes, or some other scheme, is on their side. Philosophic thinking has given us those fashionable villains, technical rationality, positivism, behaviorism, the bomb, genetic engineering, with their ardent promoters reeking of hubris. Let me give two examples of philosophic thinking, chosen serendipitously. One I was reading about a few days before writing the first draft of this section, for some reason I can't recall now, and the second arrived in the mail this morning as I was revising. First, I will briefly mention the career of some of the ideas of Ptolemy, the Egyptian astronomer and geographer, not the example that came to the mail today, whose major work was done between about 127 and 148 CE. While not the originator of some of the ideas associated with his name, he was an energetic synthesizer, and his are the works that have survived. His astronomical writings, now best known under the title Arabic scholars gave it, the Almagest, dominated astronomical theory until the 16th, or for most people, the 17th century. In Ptolemy's scheme, the Earth is the center of the universe, the sun and stars circle it, and the planets spin eccentrically around it. His geographical works also dominated people's sense of the globe for nearly a millennium and a half. Unfortunately, he accepted Posidonius' underestimation of the Earth's circumference at 180,000 stades, rather than the remarkably accurate measurement of Eratosthenes at 250,000 stades. One result of this was a serious underestimation of the distance between longitudinal lines. He also hypothesized the existence of a southern continent, Terra Australis, but he imagined it connecting the east coast of Africa with China. The reduced size of the globe would have been less of a problem if America did not exist. To use the old adage, travel broadens the mind, that is, it tends to undermine and reform one's general schemes, and the confusion of the early European explorers sailing westward with their Ptolemaic general scheme was quite understandable. They assumed they must have hit Asia somewhat sooner than expected, But after getting a sense of America's scale and then seeing the Pacific beyond, they quite reasonably experienced dumb surmise, the sound of a general scheme crumbling against a major anomaly. Similarly, the observations and calculations of Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, Kepler, 1571 to 1630, and Galileo, 1564 to 1462, pointed up anomalies in Ptolemy's scheme of the cosmos, leading to the radical revision that displaced the Earth from its center. The second example of philosophic thinking, the one that arrived in the mail today, comes from a collaborative newsletter coordinated by a remarkable teacher, Miranda Armstrong, at Eltham College, a K-12 private school north of Melbourne in Australia. She begins with a discussion she had with her son, Christopher, over breakfast, in which he suggests that trees are aliens. "What do you mean, son, that a tree is an alien being?" "Not an alien necessarily, but it might not be what we think it is. Take a spider, for instance, an inferior being by comparison to us. When they observe a house, they think of it as a natural phenomenon, a given. It is, and therefore it is real, right?" "I suppose. So what?" "So it isn't, is it? It is man-made. They believe it to be natural, when in fact it is something quite different. And take mountains." "Pardon? Humans think of mountains as natural, but what if they were actually alien artifacts? Everything we perceive is defined by what we know or think we know." "I know you are going to be late for your train." "Why do you always do that? Why, when things are just starting to get interesting, do you tell me my train is coming or my room needs tidying? How can I be late for my train after all when time is a figment of my human imagination, an invention of the mind?" The theories and hypotheses generated by Ptolemy and Christopher Armstrong are odd entities. They are not facts, nor are they generalizations from facts. They are guesses, suggestions, or assertions about the nature of things, about some whole or essence. They are based on facts and generalizations. The data on which they are based may be few or many, but the resulting schemes go beyond the sum of supporting data. Between the idea and the reality, as T.S. Eliot observed, falls the shadow. We can happily leave the shadow to philosophers, except that we need to remember it is there. Between secured knowledge and general schemes, there is an act of mind, of imagination, of faith, that generates a conception of things that is different in kind from the things themselves. In other words, the realm of theoretic thinking is distinctive not only from things, but from our more common ways of thinking about them. Philosophic thinking exercises and develops the capacity to see patterns, search for the recurrent, perceive processes, look for essences, and make ordering principles and theories. It would perhaps be more accurate to say that philosophic thinking generates the patterns, recurrence, processes, essences, ordinary principles, and theories. They are in shadowy part what the mind contributes to our knowledge of the world, in the process of making sense of it. This is clouded stuff, of no particular interest here except to help make clear that philosophic thinking has given us historically, and can give us individually, increased pragmatic control over the world. The general schemes of philosophy do not so much reduce the world as set up an additional mimic world, made of ideas, concepts, knowledge, mind stuff. We make reduced representations of reality in mind stuff, in concepts, but these reduced representations are precisely what we can deal with effectively. If we learn to make them well, we can remove all the irrelevant and confusing contingencies of reality and focus on a neat representation of the essence of something, or an underlying process, or a pattern of occurrences. The person who is skilled at philosophic thinking often seems the most effective at getting to the heart of the matter, at being able to think about an issue clearly and then act on it decisively. Such clarity and decisiveness result from what is invariably a reduction, and if the reduction ignores some relevant feature of reality, the decisive action that follows can be disastrous. But the more sophisticated philosophic thinker generates schemes that are attentive to anomalies, and that become increasingly able to reflect relevant features of reality for particular purposes. Flexible revision of general schemes is the appropriate result of education at this point. In the development of philosophic understanding, implicit features of mythic and romantic understanding become explicit, bubbling, as it were, to the surface of consciousness. Indeed, the recognition of general schemes is a central feature of philosophic understanding. They are there all along, now clearly recognized for what they are, like Hayek's operations of thought. What had undergirded mythic and romantic thinking, but had been a focus of mental attention only fitfully and vaguely, as through that glass darkly, now becomes the primary focus of mental activity. The ability to generate schematic conceptions of reality can liberate us from the constraints of the conventional ideas, beliefs, general schemes into which we grow up. Such conventions appear no longer as the unquestionable frame of conventionally perceived reality, but, rather, as general schemes that, like others, are vulnerable to anomalies and revisable. Once students begin to generate and refine general schemes, they can also recognize and similarly deal with those undergirding the conventions they inherit. Both Ptolemy's revisers and Christopher Armstrong exemplify different ways in which inherited general schemes come up for revision under the compulsion of irresistible anomalies or in the play of the exploratory imagination. The conservative political ideology of parents, which children at first tend to accept without question, comes to be seen as just one of a number of schemes that can organize the facts and events of social and political life. For students who feel irked and constrained by their parents' worldview, alternatives such as radical Marxism, feminism, environmentalism, or even stricter conservatism can be proffered against them as a truer account of reality. It may not seem much of a liberation to be taken over by one's own general schemes, rather than continuing to accept those one inherits. The inherited schemes usually have, after all, the warrant of tradition and wide acceptance. One's individually formed schemes may be eccentric. Christopher Armstrong's may seem so. But the generation of schemes is only the beginning of the process. If the student's philosophic community is effective and intellectually energetic, the schemes will quickly begin to be bitten by anomalies and will change in response, seeking further support and turning up further anomalies. Schemes such as those of Christopher Armstrong will tend to be abandoned because they cannot generate anomalies. No data can be brought to bear on them, for or against. Though many a lifelong ideological foot soldier lives with this condition without abandoning the general scheme. But even eccentric schemes are a symptom of an energetic imagination probing around in the early stages of philosophic thinking. Liberation and flexibility come from recognizing as a function of the mind what had been taken as a part of the structure of the world. Conclusion. A plethora of critiques currently focuses on what has been lost in or sacrificed to the gains of philosophic understanding. The past few decades have been noisy with complaints about the damage done by the scientific worldview, technical rationality, and so on. The main loss stems from the philosophic tendency to embrace a narrow, disembodied rationality, which links itself with the cognitive but distances itself from the affective. It encourages a division between the cognitive and the affective, and the mind and the body, in which rationality is connected with the former. The imagination is conceived as playing no significant role in cognition, and the emotions are considered likely only to infect it with confusion. This rationality is a hard, calculative, dehumanized, arid form of thought, inhospitable to myth, romance, and the body. What is lost or suppressed in this form of thought are the characteristics of mythic and romantic understanding, as well as of somatic understanding, which we will explore in Chapter 5. The initial excitement of philosophic understanding comes from a belief that one's general schemes disclose the truth about reality, often in pellucid and simple forms that draw together everything one knows. It is as though the dark glass has been drawn away, and at least one really understands. To inquisitive creatures, this discovery can come with the force of revelation. As the years go by, we may forget the ardor of early philosophic understanding, and of course, it comes to some only partially, and as a feeble glow rather than a lightning flash. But it can feel like what Faust sold his soul for. We don't see too much of the lightning flash or Faustian contracts in our schools and universities, but we do see some, and we could happily see more. Philosophic understanding is not supported by ubiquitous features of Western daily life, but mythic understanding is supported by ubiquitous oral language use, and romantic understanding is supported in the West by ubiquitous use of alphabetic literacy. Neither the mythic nor romantic kind of understanding is optimally developed by routine language and literacy uses, of course, and educational institutions can be helpful in systematically developing them. But the case of philosophic understanding seems rather different. Without the self-conscious support of educational institutions, particularly colleges and universities, philosophic understanding is likely to develop only fitfully and partially. The media and the general level of public discourse in the West do not provide the kind of community that can adequately sustain it. In recent decades, the authority and permanence that philosophic thinking has aimed at have been much criticized by sociologists of knowledge and others in the academic world, even if physical scientists do simply get on with their work as though the cacophony had nothing to do with them. My scheme, however, is a cumulative one. It does not chuck overboard philosophic understanding and its ambitions, its excitement, its capacity to search out patterns and generate laws, and its distinctive construction and revision of general schemes. In a book building a general scheme, you will not expect that. How philosophic thinking is enfolded into ironic understanding is the theme of Chapter 5. There we will try to leave nothing behind. The child is father of the man. The child is the mother of the woman.